You're sure? Carlos motions out of the terminal windows to the runway. A Gulfstream is taxiing. On the tail is the code TC816. Rosie D'Antonio's plane. And she's on it.
I can't,
starts Carlos.
Listen, I'd love to help, you know that, but, I mean, we could help each other,
suggests Eddie. Carlos looks both ways, checking to see if he is being watched, then ducks behind a computer terminal.
I gotta be mad.
Outside the window, Rosie's jet is picking up speed.
Okay,
says Carlos, coming back around from the computer.
Strictly brother to brother.
She's on board, with another woman.
Heading where?
Hawaii, says Carlos.
That's all I've got.
Eddie thinks. Are there other planes I can hire, if I wanted to go to Hawaii too?
You really like Rosie D'Antonio, huh?
Says Carlos.
It's a hobby, sure,
says Eddie. I'll walk you to the charter desk, says Carlos.
I'm sure we can get you in the air within an hour.
What on earth would Eddie have done without Carlos? He's not even going to waste his time offering him 300. Just slip him the full 1,000 for a job well done. Eddie is heading to Hawaii, and Rosie and Amy will have no idea he's on their tail. Rob is going to be very pleased with him indeed. Chapter 39. Felicity Wollaston rarely has visitors, but she has made Bonnie Gregor as welcome as she can. Fortunately, Bonnie drinks herbal tea, so Felicity hasn't had to pop out to buy milk this time.
I'm sorry to just turn up, says Bonnie. I feel silly now.
Not at all, says Felicity.
Bonnie was the lady whose email she had read.
Two kids? Something to do with houses?
It's just my friends all told me you have to shoot your shot sometimes, so I thought,
be brave, Bonnie.
Bonnie seems very nervous. Felicity can't remember the last time someone was nervous in her company.
A good maxim for life, agrees Felicity. I wonder what I might be able to do for you.
I'm not sure. I thought you could tell me.
What I could do for you?
I just typed in influencer agencies, says Bonnie.
And you were the closest, and my mum can only look after the kids for a few hours, so I thought I'd come and see you and ask you about everything.
Says Felicity.
And if you were to narrow down everything?
It's not my world, says Bonnie.
Well, I suppose it is, in a way. And I'd like it to be. It's probably ridiculous, though.
The world of influencers,
asks Felicity, looking for a foothold in the conversation.
It's just I have 14,000 followers now on Instagram, and I know that might not be enough for Vivid Viral, but maybe it is, I don't know.
Felicity senses she's been asked a question. She really should know a lot more about Vivid Viral.
14,000, says Felicity, mulling it over.
14,000, is that a lot?
Quality is often just as important as quantity, isn't it? How's your tea?
It's perfect, thank you, says Bonnie.
Calming.
Could I ask you a few questions? If you get bored, just send me away. I know you must be busy.
Felicity clicks her mouse, closing down the Sudoku she has been playing on her computer.
Ask me anything.
Bonnie takes out a notebook.
Sorry, I wrote them down. I knew I'd be nervous. What is the best way to grow and monetize my social media following?
Gosh, says Felicity. How long is a piece of string, I suppose?
Bonnie nods and writes this down.
Yes, and in numbers, what might that mean?
Well, says Felicity, it can mean whatever you'd like it to mean. What would your expectations be?
I don't need to be a millionaire or anything, says Bonnie. Just, I suppose, one day, maybe give up my job, do this full time.
Influencing.
Sorry, you think that's... No, of course, but I don't need much, says Bonnie.
Felicity is desperately trying to remember details from Bonnie's email.
Perhaps, says Felicity, perhaps I could see some examples of your... of what you do?
Of course, says Bonnie. Of course, I don't really know how these things work, sorry. I've never been in this sort of meeting before.
You and me both, thinks Felicity. But she is enjoying the company, and she realises she feels rather protective towards Bonnie. Perhaps she can put a good word in for her with her new bosses, whoever they might be.
It's all on Insta, says Bonnie, at Bonnie Inspo.
It is clear from Bonnie's body language that she is expecting Felicity to somehow use this information. On the computer, perhaps? She clicks the mouse a few times and pretends to tut.
Bloody thing, Felicity says. IT department said they'd fixed it. Perhaps you could show me on your phone?
Felicity makes her way around from behind her desk and pulls up a chair to sit next to Bonnie. How lovely to have someone in the office. Would Bonnie think it peculiar if she were to ask her out to lunch? They could go to the Pizza Express. When was the last time Felicity went there? Bonnie shows her a stream of photographs, slogans painted on walls and doors in striking pink. Lots of love and hope and cherish. Felicity isn't entirely sure what she is supposed to be looking at, but she welcomes the love and the hope.
Wonderful, says Felicity. Wonderful.
Bonnie smiles as Felicity makes her way back to her desk.
You really think?
Very vibrant, says Felicity, positive and refreshing.
Is there, Bonnie begins, do you think there might be brands who would want to work with me?
Goodness me, says Felicity, isn't that the question? I don't see why not, Bonnie.
Wow, says Bonnie. What sort of brands?
Paint, says Felicity. Paint brands, decorating.
Yes, says Bonnie. Yes, exactly. Interior design.
Interior design, agrees Felicity. Now she is starting to feel guilty. It's the happiness in Bonnie's eyes.
She should just come clean. Send Bonnie somewhere else. To someone who knows what they're doing. To someone who is not a fossil. Felicity is useless. Useless.
What sort of brands do you work with?
Felicity doesn't work with any brands. She works with UK TV Gold and sometimes the Letchworth Courier. Poor Bonnie. Felicity looks over to the pallets of products stacked up against her office wall. She points them out to Bonnie.
I mean...
Bonnie swivels and takes in the random wall of products.
Oh my God, Crusher energy drink!
Yes, says Felicity.
The purple drink she has learnt never to stare at directly.
Does that mean...
Bonnie teases. Felicity raises one eyebrow, hoping Bonnie will provide her with more information as to what that might or might not mean.
Does that mean Andrew Fairbanks?
It's precisely what that means, says Felicity, wondering who on earth Andrew Fairbanks might be.
Bonnie is shaking her head in disbelief. So Andrew Fairbanks must be a big deal.
You must be very busy at the moment. I'm so sorry.
Not at all, says Felicity, waving away the concern. Not at all, part of the job.
Andrew Fairbanks, says Bonnie. Wait till I tell my mum.
Felicity suddenly feels a ridiculous but visceral desire to be Bonnie's mother. Or grandmother. For someone to come home to her and tell her their news.
So do you think you can help? Bonnie asks.
You can say no, I promise.
Surely the big bosses at Vivid Viral owe Felicity a few favours, for whatever it is that she does for them. Surely she can send an email and recommend Bonnie. She's new, she's hungry, she'll do anything, try anything.
Felicity feels sure that they'll listen to her, and that she can help out this lovely, funny, nervous woman who has travelled to Letchworth Garden City because her friends have told her to shoot her shot.
I'll tell you what, Felicity says. Why don't we chat about it over a pizza?
Chapter 40. In the parking lot of Emery Executive Airfield, Rosie, Amy and Steve see Eddie Flood's plane fly up into the clear blue sky.
"You'll have fun in Hawaii," says Steve.
"Not as much fun as Barb and her daughter are going to have," says Rosie. They even have his name now and a scan of his passport photo from Carlos Moss. Eddie Flood, the man who has been sent to kill Amy, is currently on a 10-hour flight to a holiday paradise in pursuit of an 80-year-old health retreat owner and her grateful daughter. Steve takes his small rucksack from the back seat as Rosie's Vuitton suitcase is lifted carefully from the boot by Carlos Moss.
"St. Lucia, here we come," says Rosie.
"I'm just going to Google what's legal and illegal there."
"Thank you, Carlos," says Amy as they walk towards the terminal building.
"My pleasure, ma'am," says Carlos. "They've just refueled a Falcon for you. It's a nice one."
Ahead of them is Steve, still in t-shirt, gym shorts and combat boots, his back covered in sweat patches. Rosie is trying to take his arm, but he is resisting.
"He sure loves you, huh?" says Carlos.
"I find it quite hard to accept love," says Amy.
"I hear you," says Carlos. "You should work on that, though."
Amy nods. A porter with a trolley has arrived to take the cases. Carlos approaches Steve for a hug.
"I don't hug, I'm afraid," says Steve.
"Well, I do," says Carlos, and hugs him.
"I'm sorry I'm so sweaty," says Steve.
"It's South Carolina," says Carlos. "Sweating's what we do. You have a good flight, folks, and don't get killed. Steve and I have got airships to see."
He bows to Rosie.
"Miss D'Antonio."
"Thank you, Carlos," says Rosie. Carlos returns to work, and Rosie, Steve, and Amy head towards the tarmac.
"You should put Carlos in one of your books," says Amy, "as a thank you."
"I know Carlos very well," says Rosie. "He's already been in one of my books. You ever read While You Were Dead?"
"No point in pretending I haven't anymore," says Amy.
"So who's Carlos in that? The security guard at the end?"
"The ex-marine the writer sleeps with in the private airport terminal," says Rosie.
"Of course he is," says Amy. "Of course he is."
Rosie points the porter in the direction of their chartered plane. Chapter 41. Max Highfield is meeting Henk van Veen in the library of the Wilberforce, a London private members club just off Pall Mall. From the reception desk, he can see oak and leather and whispered conversations between men and women in suits and ties. This is where Henk likes to meet. Max has actually been here before. They sometimes hire it out for film shoots. He once shot a Nazi in the gents' toilet.
"I'm sorry, sir. No trainers,"
says a porter in a bowler hat.
"Excuse me," Max replies.
Perhaps the porter has not recognised him. Max takes off his beanie hat and runs his big hand through his thick hair with intent.
"No trainers," the porter repeats, seemingly oblivious even to the hair. "You may not have recognised me," says Max.
This, he has learned, is politer than "don't you know who I am?"
"I certainly recognise you, Mr. Highfield," says the porter. "From the films and such? It is a great pleasure to have you here at the Wilberforce, but I'm afraid that trainers are not allowed, even on your esteemed feet."
Max chooses to reason with the man.
"But these trainers cost over £700.
The porter simply raises a single eyebrow and asks,
"What? Each?"
Max is allowed everywhere, wearing anything. This is the man who went to a royal wedding barefoot and in a sarong. An Alexander McQueen sarong, certainly, but a sarong all the same. This is some insane nonsense right here. "Keep your cool, though, Max. Don't forget, the little people buy tickets."
"I'm meeting Henk van Veen," says Max.
Henk's name will carry some weight here, Max is sure of it.
"Certainly, sir," says the porter. "I believe Mr. Van Veen is waiting for you in the library, wearing shoes."
"Can I borrow some shoes?" Max asks.
"Certainly, Mr. Highfield. What size would you like?" Max Highfield's feet are a size 6.
10, please.
The porter disappears into a closet and returns with a pair of size 10 brown brogues.
Brown, says Max, but I'm wearing black. They're the only size 10s I have, I'm afraid, sir, says the porter. I have a black in a 9, if you think you could squeeze into them.
Even 10s are tight, says Max. I'll take the brown, but I need an absolute assurance I won't be photographed while I'm in the building.
Sir, this is the Wilberforce, says the porter. Within these walls you have more chance of being oil-painted than photographed.
Max nods, takes himself over to an antique banquette, and slips on his new shoes. He is proud of how he handled himself there. Old Max would have lost his temper, screamed the place down, but therapy is working nicely for him.
I very much enjoyed Rampage 7, sir, says the porter.
He's actually not that bad a guy, just doing his job.
Thanks, man, says Max. I read a lot of Chekhov and Ibsen before filming. I think it showed.
It shone through, confirms the porter.
Max feels his toes finish their journey roughly halfway down the shoe. He doesn't feel great coming to see Hank, but Jeff Nolan is no longer returning his calls. So you go to the next best option, right? It's pretty much the same service. Hank knows that Max will bring him other clients too, so there's a deal to be done there. And another message arrived on the heels of the first, a note slipped under the dressing room door. You will die, Highfield. As to where Jeff Nolan is, that's a question for other people to work out. Max has only one rule in life. Keep moving forward and never look back. Or is that two rules? His therapist asked him to think long and hard about whether this was a good tactic. Is it healthy for you and those around you, the people you work with, the people you love, to only look forward? Max had taken the therapist's advice. He had a long, hard think about it, before coming to the conclusion that, yes, it was healthy for him and for those around him. He really does love therapy. It's even tax deductible. He'd explained to his therapist, Melanie, a woman, sure, but older, so it sort of works, that after making Rampage 7, you have to make Rampage 8, right? You don't go back and make Rampage 6 again, do you? You move forward. She has countered that perhaps you didn't have to make any Rampage movies at all, and that's when he realised that, while she might be wise in all sorts of areas, she had no idea at all about box office numbers. He asked if she even read the trades, and she asked what the trades were. So that was that. Therapists can't do everything. She's very good on why his dad was never able to truly love him, but very bad on why he is so ambitious. And then it turns out Rampage 8 is actually going to be a prequel. So you can go forwards and backwards at the same time. Where does that leave her theory?
Sir, says the porter.
Hmm? Says Max.
Forgive me, sir, you've been whispering something to yourself for the last minute or so, but I wondered if I should interrupt and take you up to the library.
Yes, yes, says Max, standing.
He stands and hands the porter his trainers, neon blue and pastel pink, charcoal in the sole.
Can you assure me that no one will steal my trainers while I'm here?
The porter takes a look at the trainers.
I think I can assure you of that, sir, yes.
The porter places the trainers behind his desk and leads Max up a small flight of wide, carpeted steps. Max follows, feet slip-slapping like a police frogman on a steep canal bank. Chapter 42. Rosie and Steve are sitting on a cream leather sofa in the Falcon, looking like an extremely ill-matched mum and dad, while Amy sulkily looks at her phone in a velvet armchair opposite them. Amy and Steve are both wearing their seatbelts because the pilot had warned them of turbulence. Rosie doesn't believe in turbulence. Steve and Rosie are singing along to a song about country roads that she has never heard. If someone really is going to kill her, please let it be now. They will find out what they can about Bella Sanchez. If they can tie her killing to money smuggling too, everything will point to Lube. But if it is Lube,
What next? Where is he? Who is he, for God's sake? Her phone pings, an unknown number. I wish to speak with you. Jeff? Doesn't sound like Jeff.
But a lot of people are putting all of their communications through AI filters these days, so who knows? She replies, Jeff? Opposite her, Mum and Dad are now singing about a showgirl called Lola.
How do they know the words to these things?
No, it is Henk. Henk Van Veen, in case you know more than one Henk, which is possible. Where are you? I can help you. You want help? Henk, the man who has profited the most from these murders.
What on earth can she reply?
Where's Jeff, Henk?
She shouldn't have kept this phone, but she needs to keep the number for when Jeff finally breaks cover and needs to contact her.
I heard Jeff died. Did you hear that? I don't know. I don't think Jeff can die.
Steve raises his chin an inch in her direction. You messaging your friends?
I'm trying to find out who wants to kill me, says Amy.
It probably is one of your friends, says Rosie from the sofa.
Are you trying to kill me, Henk? You've made a bad job of it so far.
What's the play here?
I am not trying to kill you, Amy. If I was trying to kill you, you would be dead. LOL. Brackets, laughing out loud.
Who is it? Steve asks, obviously seeing her look.
Henk Van Veen, says Amy.
Jeff Nolan's old business partner, says Steve.
Amy nods. And best mate. Very Dutch. Jeff warned me about him before he went missing.
You shouldn't use your phone on a flight, says Steve.
Sure, says Amy. God forbid I should put us in danger.
Amy decides to reply to Henk, see if she can draw him out.
You know where I am, Henk. You just hired the wrong guy to follow me, and I've got $100,000, which I'm guessing belonged to you in the first place.
Amy looks at Steve. If Henk really is trying to kill her, he might well succeed. And if he does kill her, who's to say that Steve won't get caught in the crossfire too? She shouldn't have brought him out here.
A new song starts playing. Take on Me. Finally one she's heard. And now she really looks at Steve. There is something in his eyes she hasn't seen for a long time. He turns down the spliff that Rosie hands to him, but with a smile on his face that looks real. He and Rosie are singing along. Rosie is up and dancing, and Amy gets the feeling that Steve would get up and join her if the seatbelt lights weren't still on. There is another ping on her phone.
Is someone trying to kill you? I am very sorry to hear that. I am about to meet an old client of yours, and it made me think of you. I am always looking for good people to join me at Henk Industries. Can we talk?
Can we talk? That again. No, Henk, we cannot talk.
Amy slides the SIM card from her phone, takes some nail scissors from her bag and cuts it into small pieces. Jeff will find a way of reaching her. She instantly feels freer. Just her, Steve and Rosie against the world now. Amy is half expecting Steve to tell her she's not allowed to take scissors on a plane, but she sees that he is too busy preparing his falsetto for the chorus of Take On Me. The chorus begins, and the three of them belt it out together, as the shape of St. Lucia comes into view in the Caribbean Sea far below.
Chapter 43. A few years ago, Max Highfield would have felt out of place in this room, but now Max doesn't feel out of place anywhere. He's earned the right to go where he chooses, when he chooses, even if sometimes he's not allowed to wear his trainers. Max can't help worrying that the porter just put his trainers behind a reception desk rather than putting them in a locker or, better still, a safe. The library has floor-to-ceiling shelves, floor-to-ceiling windows, a temple to dark oak and green leather and books. There are writing desks along a side wall, circular tables covered in new books and thick magazines. The light is provided by three huge chandeliers with a succession of brass reading lamps. It's so big that Max thinks he could strip the whole lot out
and have room for a swimming pool, gym and sauna complex if this was his own house. And he could call his complex the library to show that he is a reader. Henk is hidden away behind the medical periodicals, filling the corner of a large green leather sofa, a book open in his hand. The only other person in the library is a woman in her 80s, reading a book on the philosophy of grief. She clocked him as he came in, though. He can always tell. Max takes a deep armchair opposite Henk. Henk puts down his book and nods towards it.
Spinoza, says Henk. Have you read him?
Spinoza, says Max. No. Good?
Not bad, says Henk.
Not bad. And in my view, without Spinoza, we have no Kant. We have no Goethe.
No, agrees Max. Do we even have George Eliot, I wonder? Henk asks.
Do we have Middlemarch without this Dutch genius? Henk chuckles, and so Max does too, then says,
thanks for seeing me. I was expecting you, says Henk. A lot of problems at your current agency. Can be so easy for you to stay loyal.
I stay loyal to Max Highfield, says Max.
That is a moral paradox, says Henk.
Thanks, says Max. Someone said Jeff's dead, like in real life.
Jeff, says Henk, as if remembering a forgotten childhood friend. He is no longer my concern, Max. Sometimes people who live by the sword also die by the sword.
Max looks quizzical.
Are you talking about that film I did, Die by the Sword?
No, says Henk. It's an idiom.
Agree to disagree, says Max. I don't suppose you'd be interested in looking after my close protection needs.
In looking after you, says Henk.
I think that sounds wise. I think even our friend Spinoza might approve, don't you?
I mean, if I joined you, says Max, I have certain needs, expectations.
Full security cover, says Henk. 24/7. You take your pick of my people, and I give you $2 million a year to act as an ambassador.
Max picks up a book from the oak table beside his armchair. It is called 14th Century Iran, The Howl of Uncertainty. He puts it down.
Is there something else, Max? Henk asks.
Max takes a card from his jacket and gives it to Henk.
You're dead.
My, my. Any idea who this might be from?
None, says Max. I'm universally loved. They even said that in Grazia.
I shall look into it for you, says Henk. It seems that Maximum Impact are not taking care of you as they should. Max picks up his book again, before remembering that it is called 14th Century Iran, The Howl of Uncertainty. He puts it down once again.
Have a lot of Jeff's clients come to you, says Max.
The seagulls follow the trawler, says Henk. Max nods.
And did you really tell Jeff I didn't hold my gun properly?
Excuse me, Max.
In Rampage 7.
I don't know what Rampage 7 is. Now Max laughs.
Nice one, Henk.
Thank you, Max, says Henk. Max stands and slaps Henk on the back.
You get a contract knocked up and I'll sign it.
Pleasure seeing you, Max, says Henk, returning to his book. I will ensure that nobody kills you. As Max leaves, he sees that the old woman reading the book about grief is silently sobbing. Max studies her for a while, pretending to be reading a magazine about yachts. Max has never quite been able to cry on camera. If he ever sees crying in a script, he makes sure they change it to a roar of anger, which he can do very well. He approaches the woman, places a hand on her shoulder, and gives his kindest smile.
Would you like an autograph?
The woman looks up, tears still streaming down her face.
I'm afraid I don't know who you are, dear. I would advise you to take your hand off my shoulder, though.
Max nods slowly. He gets it. Grief does the funniest things to people.
Chapter 44.
Amy has been in mortal danger in many countries over the last few years, but St. Lucia has to be one of the most beautiful. Only country in the world named after a woman, Rosie tells her. What about Georgia? Says Amy. Georgia is named after St. George, says Steve. And he and Rosie roll their eyes at each other. Amy could live without that little alliance developing. They are climbing higher and higher on the coast road, endless blue falling away to one side of them and endless mountainous green rising up on the other. Colourful villages cling to bends in the road, with wooden porches looking out over the Caribbean. Amy is enjoying the view, but she is also aware that Steve has been determinedly looking down at his phone for the entire ride. It's a beautiful view, Steve, says Amy.
I'm okay, says Steve, still looking at his phone. We're going much higher, Ferdy.
Ferdy, the taxi driver, turns around almost 180 degrees. Another 2 kilometres up, then 3 kilometres down. You want me to speed up?
Yes, please, say Amy and Rosie. No thanks, says Steve, eyes still glued to the phone on his lap.
Amy looks down at the phone. What are you reading?
Nothing, says Steve.
Amy takes a closer look. He does actually mean nothing. The phone is off. Why is your phone off?
I read something in the paper about roaming charges when you go abroad. Someone went to Tenerife and had a 5 grand bill, so I'm keeping it off.
If it's off, says Rosie from the passenger seat, why are you looking at it?
We just, says Steve, tilting his head towards the window without raising it. We're just quite high up, and I don't see any barriers.
Ferdy turns 180 degrees again.
You're safe with me. Never had a fatal accident.
Turn your phone back on, says Amy. It won't cost you anything unless you download something without Wi-Fi.
Will they have Wi-Fi at the hotel? Steve asks. One of Condé Nast's 10 most luxurious hotels in the world, says Rosie.
Yes, they might have Wi-Fi. Steve switches his phone back on, and it slowly springs to life with message alerts. Are any of those from Hampshire Police? Asks Amy.
They're mainly Margaret from next door, sending me pictures of trouble.
Trouble? Says Rosie, reacting to the word like a meerkat.
Steve's cat, says Amy.
A cat called Trouble, says Rosie. I like the sound of her.
Him, says Steve.
Well, you can't have everything, says Rosie.
Ferdy, why does everybody here wave at you?
They all know me, says Ferdy. I'm a politician. They see me on the news sometimes.
And Company's House have sent me all the information I requested on Vivid Viral.
And? Asks Amy.
It seems to be a new name for an older company. Felicity Wollaston Associates, says Steve. A theatrical agency, TV and what have you.
Can I ask why you're driving a taxi? Rosie asks Ferdy, if you're a politician.
Because I always lose, says Ferdy, swerving at the last moment to avoid a concrete truck. Every time I lose.
Ferdy beeps his horn at a group of young children waving at him from a bright yellow veranda.
They still seem to like you, though, says Rosie.
That's because I lose, says Ferdy. If I'd won, they'd hate me.
That's politics.
Felicity Wollaston is the sole director of the company, says Steve, born 18th of March, 1951.
Is that before or after you, Rosie? Amy asks.
I'm talking to Ferdy, dear, Rosie replies. What's a woman in her 70s doing single-handedly running a digital media agency? Amy shrugs. Perhaps Steve does have a point, though. Why Vivid Viral?
Amy will be annoyed if this whole investigation ends up being solved by Company's House rather than by a gunfight.
Will you look into her a bit more? Steve nods.
Soon as I've got Wi-Fi.
Just a little way to Emerald Bay now, says Ferdy from the front. Amy sees Steve breathe a slight sigh of relief.
Though I should warn you, says Ferdy, the last stretch is terrifying.
Amy sees Steve's knuckles whiten around his phone.
God bless that man.
Do you take everyone to Emerald Bay? Rosie asks Ferdy. You're the official driver.
Most people, says Ferdy. Sure, most people.
Some people take a helicopter because the drive is so dangerous. Or you can take the boat. Much safer. Zero deaths.
I don't suppose you took this woman. Bella Sanchez?
Rosie asks, showing Ferdy a picture of Bella Sanchez. Ferdy takes the briefest of glances.
I remember her, says Ferdy.
You drove her? Asks Amy from the back. No, but I remember her, says Ferdy. She got picked up by a private car. Never saw it before.
Did you see the driver? Amy asks.
Only when they crashed, says Ferdy.
They crashed, says Rosie.
Everybody crashes, says Ferdy.
Except you, says Amy, squeezing Steve's hand.
Oh, I crash plenty, says Ferdy.
Don't you worry about that.
That final kilometre is crazy. They won't pave it, because they want the resort to be private. If it was easy to get to, everyone would drive down and use the beach. All the beaches here are public.
So you saw the driver?
Saw her, says Ferdy. Tried to drag the car out too. Went about 2 meters down the rocks, got stopped by a tree. I stopped to give them a hand.
Could you describe the driver?
White lady, says Ferdy. Long red hair, baseball cap. Sounds a lot like the same woman who picked up Andrew Fairbanks, so proof, at least, that the deaths are connected. Amy is glad of the certainty.
Did you happen to see Miss Sanchez's luggage at all? Asks Rosie.
Sure, says Ferdy. Clambered down the rocks to get it for her. 3 big cases.
You can't carry 3 cases, says Amy.
I carried 2, says Ferdy. The driver insisted on carrying the other one.
What sort of bag was that? Rosie asks.
Big leather holdall, says Ferdy. Brown. Expensive looking.
Anything like this bag? Amy asks.
She shows Ferdy a photograph of the bag found with Andrew Fairbanks on the yacht, the bag containing the money.
Identical, says Ferdy. Same bag.
For the first time, Steve dares to look up.
Same driver, same bag.
Amy nods. That's more like it. Forget company's house. A real-life killer and a real-life bag of money.
I told you it was worth coming to St. Lucia, says Rosie.
You guys movie people? Ferdy asks.
Sounds like you're working on a script. We get a lot of movie people here. Stallone was here. He couldn't believe I was more famous than him.
Just tourists, says Steve.
Private tourists, says Amy. So if anyone ever describes us to you, you never met us?
I never speak about anyone I drive, says Ferdy.
You have total privacy.
Though you did just tell us about Stallone, says Rosie.
Yeah, says Ferdy. But with respect to the three of you, that's Stallone, isn't it?
And if anyone tries to ask you about Bella Sanchez, says Steve, will you let me know? I'll leave my number with you.
You got it, boss, says Ferdy.
Yeah, she got real lucky, that Bella Sanchez. Couple of feet either side of that tree. And she could have died that day.
Lucky, lucky lady.
Up to a point, says Rosie.
Okay, says Ferdy. Final kilometre. Buckle up, it's a bumpy ride.
Rosie claps her hands with delight. Amy sees Steve once again staring determinedly at his phone. She squeezes his arm.
You just keep pretending to read your emails. I won't let anything happen to you.
Steve continues staring.
I'm not pretending to read.
Email from Hampshire Police.
About Jeff? Amy asks.
Still no contact from him.
The blood in the car, says Steve.
It was Jeff's. They checked it against his file at work, and there was an awful lot of it in that car.
This sounds exciting, says Ferdy from the front.
Steve is reading on. They're saying he must be dead.
A lot of people die in cars, says Ferdy, turning round to Steve and nodding.
Jeff's not dead, says Amy, though with a little less conviction than she has managed before.
If he's not dead, where is he? Why isn't he helping her? And if he is dead, who killed him? Henk?
They were best friends, the two of them, before all this.
A silence descends.
The car is shaking and rattling on the dirt road like a washing machine on spin cycle.
This is the most action I've had in weeks, says Rosie.
Where would a woman buy drugs around here, Ferdy?
Some boys in Soufriere, down by the jetty. They'll get you anything you need, says Ferdy.
No, says Rosie. Real drugs, kilos, that sort of thing. If I had a bag full of cash, where would I be taking it?
Nelson Nunez, says Ferdy. Lives up at Bluff Point, about 5 miles up the coast. But if you visit without an appointment, he'll kill you. And if you do have an appointment, he'll probably kill you too. But at least you'll know when.
Is he a friend of yours? Asks Rosie.
I know him enough, says Ferdy. You want to meet him?
Very much, says Amy from the back. Bella Sanchez brought money into the country. That money wasn't found. Nelson Nunez sounds like a good place to start looking for it.
If someone was murdered on St. Lucia, says Rosie, is Nelson the sort of man who might know who did it?
Nelson, says Ferdy.
Sure, if he didn't do it himself.
When's this movie coming out? You need a driver?
Driver, says Rosie.
I see you more as an actor, Ferdy.
I'll talk to him, says Ferdy, nodding in agreement. Tell him a big-name writer wants to talk to him.
Amy has yet to encounter a door that wasn't open to Rosie D'Antonio.
How do you know Nelson Nunez, Ferdy? Amy asks.
He's the one who always beats me in the elections.
Chapter 45.
Steve has never been anywhere like it. There is a swimming pool, actually, inside his room. Brilliant sapphire blue, marbled with dancing veins of sunlight in gold and silver. Tiny birds are cheeping and chirruping on the wide, high terrace, and three bottles of beer sit sweating with frost in an ice bucket. In the far distance, twin volcanoes jut out into the sea. Two perfect triangles dipping their toes into the Caribbean. They hadn't crashed, and this suite is Steve's reward. He takes out the dictaphone and looks down to the bay, where colourful dive boats crisscross the waves.
Hey, Dollface, I'm sitting on a balcony next to a private pool in the biggest hotel room I've ever seen. It's bigger than our house. Well, until we put the conservatory on. Then it's probably about the same. I'm even wearing shorts, so get your laughing out the way. I've still got shoes and socks on, though.
You wanted to go to the Caribbean. You sent me links and all sorts. It was always the wrong time of year, though. You know I did my research. I couldn't find a single month that wasn't either too rainy or too hot or too expensive. And I read about the hurricanes, too, because that would be just my luck. And you said, one day, and I agreed, one day for sure, didn't I? But that day never came, eh? Sorry, Debs. Sorry for not living when I had the chance.
Steve opens one of the ice-cold beers and calms himself down.
Rosie knows the bloke who owns this, so we're all in suites. She's in the presidential suite. They threw out the Prime Minister of Japan to put her in there. We're all off to see a man called Nelson Nunez tomorrow, a drug dealer. I'm assuming drug dealers are roughly the same in St. Lucia as they are in London. I'll let you know. Unless I'm cut down in a hail of gunfire, in which case I'll see you, won't I? I'll be walking through the door full of bullets, great big smile on my face. Give you a big cuddle.
Steve switches off the dictaphone and breathes deeply before switching it back on. He feels shaky and tearful. He'd been warned about jet lag.
There are restaurants here that do all sorts. They've got barbecue on the beach, they've got Italian. I missed Bolognese night at the Brass Monkey, as you know. They've got fresh sea fish in a little shack. We should have come out, shouldn't we? We should have. God, I'm sorry, I'm hopeless. I could have sat by the pool while you went scuba diving or talked to people. I don't know why I didn't just do it. We should have taken our chances with the weather. It's nice out here now. Hot, but with a breeze off the sea.
When you get here, luxury resorts aren't actually as bad as you think.
What does Steve need to ask Debbie about the case?
So Bella Sanchez had a bag full of money too and got picked up by the same driver as Fairbanks, which means it's all connected. So we're looking for this Francois Loubet and trying to work out who was involved at Maximum Impact.
Steve pauses for a moment, listening to what Debbie has to say about it all.
I know, doll. I know I'm tired of saying it to Rosie and Amy, but you're right. The Vivid viral agency thing is the bit that really makes no sense. I'm starting to think I might not be back in England anytime soon, so I need to find another way to take a look at them. Also, there's this guy Henk, who started his own close protection business 3 months ago, which is convenient timing.
A bell rings at the door of the suite, and Steve puts down his machine and answers the door. A young St. Lucian man in a jade uniform has a large black bag folded over his arm. He gives it to Steve.
From Miss D'Antonio in the presidential suite, sir? A suit to wear for this evening's dinner?
A suit, says Steve. I don't need a suit to eat a barbecue.
Sir, says the young man, tonight you are dining at our sushi restaurant with the owner of Emerald Bay.
Oh, man. Sushi.
Miss D'Antonio also said you can wear it to meet the drug dealer tomorrow. I didn't wish to pass this message on, sir, but she gave me a substantial tip.
Steve thanks the young man and takes the suit inside. He throws it on the bed before thinking that, actually, he should probably hang it up. He picks up the dictaphone again.
Bloody sushi in a bloody suit. First I missed the bolognese, now this. I wonder if Tony Taylor would drive up to Letchworth for me, have a poke around. That's a thought, isn't it?
Steve looks out over the Caribbean Sea and feels the breeze on his face. He extends an arm to one side and imagines for a moment that Debbie is there with him, safe in his embrace. But she is not in his embrace, and she was not safe, and a better man than Steve would have come here long ago. What chances he had.
If there's trouble tomorrow, if bullets fly his way, if one should hit him, would that be such a bad thing?
There is another knock at the door. Steve finishes his message. Love you, baby. I'm so sorry you couldn't come here with me. He opens the door to Rosie D'Antonio.
Hello, Stevie, says Rosie. Have you been crying?
No, says Steve, honestly, before registering the heat behind his eyes and realizing that he has.
Why did you buy me a suit?
Rosie smiles.
One of my favorite things in the world is handsome men who are very badly dressed. There's so much you can do with them.
I don't wear suits, says Steve.
You have very certain rules, Stevie, says Rosie.
I know what I like and what I don't like, says Steve.
That is very evident, Stevie, says Rosie.
You like your routine?
Yes.
You like your home?
Yes.
You like to feel safe and you like to feel prepared?
Yes.
I see, says Rosie.
And how is all that working out for you?
It's working out well, says Steve. But the question has hit home. His world has become so small. What must Amy think of him? What must Debbie have thought?
Good, says Rosie. Now take my arm and let's walk along the beach and talk about murder. And then you can tell me all about your beautiful wife and how much you miss her.
Would you like that?
Steve nods. He would.
I would too, says Rosie.
Chapter 46. Amy is running along a sandy beach, her feet splashing in the water every time a wave comes in. Her wraparound sunglasses and her headphones cocoon her. She speeds up, sprinting now, the effort beginning to show on her face. As she passes a bright yellow rowing boat pulled up onto the beach, Amy collapses to the ground, as if she has reached an imaginary finishing line. Taking huge gulps of air, she looks back towards the beautiful resort that towers over Emerald Bay, and then looks around the desirable stretch of beach she now finds herself on. She takes out a cheap phone and punches in a number. Susan Knox is at her desk, trading software open in front of her. A mobile phone buzzes somewhere, but she can't immediately locate it. It is certainly not the one on her desk. She searches for a moment before realizing the buzzing is coming from the bottom drawer of her desk. At speed, she reaches her arm underneath her desk and knocks on a panel. A key drops to the floor. The mobile is still ringing as she grabs the key and uses it to unlock the bottom drawer. The ringing gets louder as she pulls out a phone and answers. Jeff? It's Amy.
Jesus, Amy, says Susan.
You're still alive?
Out of breath, but alive, says Amy.
So nothing from Jeff?
Nothing, says Susan. You?
I'm uncontactable, says Amy. Hank was trying to track me down. I didn't like it.
What do you need, Amy? Did you find anything in the files I sent you?
This is going to sound ridiculous, says Amy. But the blood tests we do.
The drugs tests?
Where are they kept?
Susan stops for a moment. She looks over her shoulder.
So Jeff told you what happened, Susan says.
There is no reply from Amy.
Amy, the room was locked and the freezer was locked. We have no idea how it happened, and I promise it won't happen again.
Remind me again, says Amy. It was only my blood that went missing?
Only yours, says Susan.
Full disclosure, Amy, I thought maybe you'd stolen it yourself, you know, because you were worried about what it would show. So I didn't look into it as much as I should have. And Jeff didn't disagree.
Well, I didn't take it, says Amy, but somebody did.
Who would have access?
10 or 12 people at most, says Susan. Our medical people, some of the senior staff. Anyone else would have to have found a way to break in.
You'd have access, Amy asks.
Me, absolutely, says Susan.
And Jeff?
Jeff, yes, says Susan.
There is another pause.
Remind me how long ago this was. I don't think Jeff was clear.
End of April, says Susan.
Something like that.
I'm really terribly sorry, Amy. It shouldn't have happened, and I shouldn't have suspected it was you.
And Hank was still at the company then, says Amy. He would have had access too.
He would, confirms Susan.
And could any clients have had access? Amy asks.
I mean, we show people around from time to time, says Susan, to show off our facilities. But I don't see how that could happen.
If anyone speaks to you, the police, Hank, anyone, you haven't heard from me.
Of course, says Susan.
Amy, what's happening? Where on earth is Jeff? Are you safe?
I don't think anyone is safe, Susan, says Amy.
Chapter 47.
Rob Kenner, his ball in a bunker, is not best pleased. Eddie has flown to Hawaii, and Amy Wheeler, according to sources, is alive and well in St. Lucia. Well, of course she is. He should have anticipated that. It seems she's following the path of the murders, investigating them, presumably. She won't find anything there. Rob's fairly sure of that. The Bella Sanchez murder was just another local cop earning a payday, with no idea who from. Same if Amy decides to go to Ireland.
But she'll be dead before she gets the chance.
The key thing is to surround yourself. Layer upon layer of people. And you'd have to unreel an awful lot of layers before you got to Rob Kenner. Still, you have to protect each and every layer if you can. Francois Lube is the same. This is the fourth job Rob has had from him. And he's still never met the man. Wouldn't recognize him if he passed him in the street. Layer upon layer upon layer. Eddie's getting the first plane over from Hawaii, which is expensive, but money's no object with Lube. So now Rob has to find Eddie a gun in St. Lucia. He'll talk to the guy who helped him out before, Nelson Nunez. The nice thing about Dubai, one of the many nice things, is that a man like Rob can get
everything he needs. You need a gun in St. Lucia? You just chat to the Chilean arms dealer with the villa up the street from yours. He talks to a Venezuelan drugs middleman he knows from the tennis club and, before you know it, introductions are made, encrypted emails are sent, and Nelson Nunez is hiding a semi-automatic pistol under an unusually shaped rock on a St. Lucian back road. Dubai really is that sort of community. Everyone helps everyone. Rob doesn't want to let Lu Bei down, though. That could be very dangerous.
You look like you've got the worries of the world on your shoulders, says Big Mick.
Work, says Rob. Big Mick laughs.
I remember work. Overrated.
Mick, a proper old geezer, sold his scrap metal yard and retired out here 10 years ago. Not much of a conversationalist, but lives next to the course and always free for a game of golf. The men play a couple of times a week. He hacks his ball out of the bunker and levers himself back onto terra firma. Rob and Mick walk down towards the green, Big Mick's ball a good 20 yards or so to the left of Rob's. As he waits for Big Mick to reach his ball, Rob sends a message to Nelson Nunez. Rob writes,
"Friend visiting, needs gun. Same place, same terms, 24 hours.
Big Mick has reached his ball and signals for Rob to hit his next shot. It lands in a bit of trouble about 5 yards over the green. Rob likes landing in trouble. It forces you to use your brain to adapt. Up ahead, Big Mick hits his next to within 8 feet of the hole. Nelson replies, "I have the perfect thing. Advise if further help needed." Rob realizes that Nelson might actually be of further use. Much as he loves Eddie, his old pal might need some help finding where Amy Wheeler is. And if Rob knows islands, it won't have escaped St. Lucia that Rosie D'Antonio has come visiting. If you hear where Rosie D'Antonio is, let me know. The person she's travelling with is the target. Nelson replies, "I might be able to take care of it myself, for a fee." That's a thought. Eddie might take a while to arrive and Nelson Nunez knows his work.
Sure, if opportunity presents itself. 200, but don't harm Rosie D'Antonio. Too much publicity if she dies.
Nelson replies with a thumbs up. Rob is reassured. It's a small island, and he has Eddie Flood and Nelson Nunez to help him. If one of them doesn't kill Amy Wheeler, the other one surely will. Big Mick and Rob reach the green. Big Mick steps onto the beautifully manicured surface, a nice gentle putt in front of him, while Rob just keeps on walking towards the deep trouble. Chapter 48.
May I make you a cup of tea, Mr. Taylor?
Only if you're having one, says Tony Taylor. I don't want to impose.
Couldn't harm, could it? After your journey?
The journey had been a pleasant surprise, if Tony Taylor is honest. The A31 turned out to be clear as a bell. Couldn't believe his luck there. M27, no major problems. The traffic backed up around junction 2 of the M3, but when doesn't it? The usual fun and games on the M25, but then clear from junction 9 all the way to Letchworth Garden City. So, all in all, Tony couldn't complain. Should have taken 2 hours and 23 minutes, actually took 2 hours and 15 minutes. Tony had been tempted to say no to the whole plan, but Steve was a good mate, and so, against his better judgment, he decided that, just this one time, he would risk the traffic.
Couldn't harm at all, says Tony. Nice cuppa.
He gave back the time he'd saved, however, because parking was prohibitive in the centre of Letchworth Garden City.
£2.40 an hour, he'd said to the attendant. Who do you think I am? Rockefeller.
And so he had parked on a residential street 8 minutes away from Felicity Wollaston's office. So it was swings and roundabouts.
A nice cuppa, agrees Felicity. She must be, what, 70-odd? Good nick. Great hair. I'm guessing you'd like PG tips.
Then you're guessing right, says Tony. Give that woman a goldfish.
Felicity laughs as she fills the kettle.
Apropos of absolutely nothing, Tony thinks she has a delightful laugh.
Thanks for seeing me at short notice, says Tony. I'm not really in show business, so I've no idea how it all works.
What are you in, Mr. Taylor? Felicity asks as she uncouples a pair of tea bags.
Cars, says Tony. And call me Tony. Only the tax man calls me Mr. Taylor.
Felicity laughs again.
Tax man, indeed. Are you sure you're not in comedy? You're a hoot.
Tony knows he is a funny guy, but people often tell him that he's not. It is refreshing to see his banter making an impact. And on a professional.
Steve had called him yesterday, outlined what he needed. Just a bit of info, Tony, tell a few white lies.
Like a spy? Tony had asked. And Steve had said, well, no, not really, just a friendly chat.
See what you can see.
And Tony had said, well, that sounds a lot like a spy to me.
And Steve had said, look, mate, would it make you happier if I said you were a spy?
And Tony had said, me? No, no skin off my nose. I'm just saying, call it what it is.
And Steve had said, okay, you're a spy. And Tony had sucked his teeth and given it some thought and said, okay, I'll do it. For you, mate. I'll spy.
Then they'd talked about the weather in St. Lucia for a bit, too hot. But Tony could have told him that, and how Amy was, she's very well, and what Rosie D'Antonio was like. Very much her own woman, apparently.
So what brings you to Letchworth Garden City, Tony? Felicity asks.
My nephew, says Tony. He's an influencer, you see.
I see, says Felicity, filling their mugs.
What area?
Southampton, says Tony.
No, what's his area, his speciality? Who does he influence?
Tony knew he should have thought his story through more on the journey up. But spies have to think quick.
Spies, says Tony. The word was in his head, and now it is on the table.
Spies, says Felicity. Goodness me. How does one influence spies?
Instagram, says Tony. He had done some thinking.
And what does he do on Instagram?
Tony hadn't expected the third degree. He takes a sip of his tea. It is much too hot, but it gives him vital thinking time.
Gadgets, secret bugs, and spy guns.
Is that tea not too hot? Asks Felicity.
No, it's perfect, says Tony.
So what does a viral media company do?
Gracious, says Felicity. I mean, what don't we do?
Yeah, says Tony. It's like when people ask what I do all day. Clutches, brake pedals, dings. Used to do MOTs but lost my license.
Exactly, says Felicity. Clutches, brake pedals, etc.
Etc., agrees Tony.
But if my nephew... What's your nephew's name, Tony?